This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this morning I'm joined by Ben Day, plural site author, coach, trainer, developer, and available for hire at www.benday.com. Thank you for joining me, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
First of all, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
Well, it all started in 1974. after years of being a big old nerd, I went to music school and then thought I was going to be a jazz pianist, and well, that didn't pan out, so I decided to do software. So, you know, last 15 years or so has been software architecture, speaking at conferences, writing, DevOps, assorted nerdery.
I met you through your meetup group, the Dev Boston one in Boston, obviously enough, and you've been running that for how long?
Man, that's probably 10, 11 years at this point. Wow, I'm old.
And that's about once a month that you have events, usually in the Cambridge area.
Yeah, something like that. So just out of full disclosure, I'm the co-leader of that with Jason Haley. And by co-leader, it means that I pretty much let Jason do all the work. So it's a good time.
So aside from those things, what else do you do? You said you're a developer.
Yeah. So, well, lately my summer has been Pluralsight. So, I've got a whole bunch of classes up on Pluralsight, and, just finished recording and editing, my DevOps for, Team Foundation Server 2015 course. So that should be dropping any time now. And then I'm actually trying to take a little bit of vacation now that we're sort of at the tail end of summer and looking for my next project, and we'll see what happens.
Just on the Pluralsight, I've been using Pluralsight for years, and I've seen that the number of courses are increasing, and I know some of the authors. But you're making it sound like it's almost a full-time job for you for at least some part of the year?
Well, it takes a lot to record one of those courses. Like, I was talking to another author, Brian Noyce. He's out of Virginia, and we were talking about how long it takes us to do it, and it takes us about 1 week per module. So my last course is 11 modules, or the DevOps course is 11 modules, and it's about 7 hours, and I think it easily took me 2 months of just sort of the recording and editing and then the tweaking of demos and all that kind of stuff. But what's kind of nice about Pluralsight is, you know, in the beginning when Fritz Onion and Aaron Sconard were trying to get me to join up, I was kind of like, yeah, whatever, you know, sure, I'll crank out a course. And I did one, and I did another, and another, and another. And then at some point it sort of turns into like an actual real source of income. So I'm trying to keep that going. Like, my first course was a TFS 2012 course, which now that we're in 2016, that stuff is pretty much, you know, that's pretty long tail at this point. So I really am trying to get in there and do some more stuff. We'll do the next course and see how it goes.
And just to one final thing, when you were saying it's 1 week per module, are you talking a 40-hour week or a 20-hour
yeah.
week?
I dove however you say that. I jumped in on the DevOps course probably like in June. So June through now, I've been doing almost exclusively that. I mean, the last 2 months have just been solid Pluralsight for me. I'd probably procrastinate a little bit. So there are moments, but you know, with that moments, like whenever you're writing these things, a lot of it is you're sort of polishing it in your head. And there are at least a couple of modules where I went through, recorded it, and once I got to editing, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. And you just dump it, re-edit the slides, redo it. And yeah, it's intense, but it's so awesome when it's done. Like, you know, it's basically like writing a book.
I think people don't realize the amount of effort that goes into these things. And just on a personal note, I've had people ask me occasionally, you know, how much time does it take to make a podcast? And I've worked it out at between about 6 and 8 hours for 30 to 40 minutes of audio between contacting the person, arranging the times, arranging the questions, making the recording, doing the edits, preparing the post, checking the audio, putting the music at both sides, cleaning it up. It's incredible. And then you throw video onto that. And you have to be accurate, whereas I can let things slip. I don't mind.
It's insane. Like, actually, when I'm thinking about it, like, some of those modules. So there's 11 modules in that course. After I finish recording my demos, I might have 45 to 60 minutes worth of video per clip. And there's probably 8 clips per module. And then you edit that down to maybe 20 minutes or something. It's crazy. And the editing takes forever.
Yeah, I agree.
But if you don't, I've thought about, like, could I outsource the editing to somebody else? But I just don't think that I could, because what I'm trying to craft in my story, for lack of a better word, what I'm trying to say in that, it's hard for anyone else to know.
No, I understand. And we're going to come back to your DevOps related topic in a little while. But first, you've been an Agile and Scrum coach for quite some time. And what we're going to primarily talk about are maybe the problems that you see with Scrum. But first of all, before we get onto the problems, can you just briefly tell me what Agile and Scrum are and why they're good?
Okay, so back in the 2000s or so, there was, you know, all these software luminaries got together, Ken Schwaber, Jeff Sutherland, a bunch of other people. And they came together because they were grumpy about the state of how software development was going. This is back in the time of Waterfall and RUP and, like, fairly heavyweight processes. And that, in their grumpiness, when they all got together, that turned into the Agile Manifesto, which I don't have memorized. But it basically was like, let's talk more, write fewer requirements, and let's focus on done working software. Now, this is a podcast for nerdy people. So the way that I think of it is that Agile is an abstract base class. So you can't go into a company and say, let's do Agile. Why? Because all the important methods are not implemented. Scrum is the concrete class that implements the abstract base methods. And then that gives you the set of dance steps for how you actually will be Agile and how an organization can do Scrum. So Scrum, the way that we tend to think of it in the Scrum.org community, is done working software in 30 days or less.
When you say Scrum is one of the implementations of this base class, what would be another?
I don't know. I think that the biggest one that we have to fight against is nothing in particular. So it's really, Scrum owns the majority of the marketplace. You've got Kanban that's in there, but Kanban's not quite as prescriptive on how you actually do things. It's a lot more focused on, well, the Kanban people will be annoyed at me for saying this, but basically moving tickets through a flow of development and delivery, where Scrum is a lot more planning. Scrum is trying to say, here's what we're going to do in 30 days. And it's kind of like the scientific method. Like, here's our hypothesis for what we're going to get done. We're going to go try to do it. And at the end, we're going to pause and see, did we meet our hypothesis or not? And if we did, yay. If we didn't, we'll try to figure out why we didn't actually make our hypothesis so that we can hopefully get better.
I remember maybe a year and a half ago, you were presenting at a code camp in Boston. And you were talking about your role as a consultant going into companies, trying to help them get Agile and Scrum going. And I remember a comment from you that you go in, they pay you well, and then they ignore everything you said and go back to doing what they were doing before.
Yeah. Yes. Well, it depends. Like, on, like, some customers are ready to get into really doing things. Like, Agile and Scrum, a lot of times requires a lot of cultural shift. Like, what's great about waterfall project management or Gantt charts is that you've got this Gantt chart that says, here's what our plan is from now until 6 months from now, or now until 12 months from now. And it feels really good because you've got the sense of control. Here's what our plan is going to be. But the problem is, once you get going, the plan is toast, and it doesn't match reality. With Scrum, you're not trying to pin down what you're going to do for much more than 30 days. And that can be really hard for executives and really hard for project managers and hard for developers too, hard for teams to know what they're going to do, because they're kind of used to, here's what the plan is, and now we're going to work the plan, as opposed to, we're going to be continually replanning every day to make sure that we're on target. So when I go into companies, if they've got a handful of people at the top that are command and control managers, you know, that they just kind of want to give you an order and expect you to do it without a whole lot of discussion, you're going to have a hard time rolling out Scrum and Agile at that place.
If you get away with that part of it, and there is some buy-in, in the prep for this, you were telling me that there are a set of common problems that occur within Scrum. Do you want to go through a few of those?
Well, yeah, let's hop in with the thing we're famous for. Like, if you were to go ahead and ask somebody, tell me one thing about Scrum, you know, it's not going to be backlog management. It's going to be the daily Scrum meeting, right? So Scrum is kind of famous for having a 15-minute meeting, which in a lot of organizations, people are just super bored in that meeting and they don't pay attention. Now, I wrote an article, and then in my Pluralsight Scrum Master Skills class, I talked at length about why your daily Scrum is boring and useless. And one of them is, well, I don't know. Have you worked in a Scrum team before?
A few times, yeah. And sometimes they have been, as you say, just ignoring, because there's five sets of projects going on and I'm working on one, and I'm maybe a lone developer, and then I just don't really care what the other people are doing because it's completely disconnected from what I'm doing. And some people are overly verbose.
Right. Well, I think you just nailed the problem right there. Is that in that meeting, if everyone doesn't care about the same thing, then that meeting is not really very relevant. So the idea is that as a team, you come together and plan out what you're going to do for the next 24 hours. It's basically the team's 24-hour opportunity to inspect and adapt. So inspect, see where they're at towards delivering done working software at the end, and adapt, meaning change what your plan is for how you get to that done working software at the end. So what typically happens, or what quite often will happen on teams, is that they'll have, let's say, five PBIs, features that they're going to work on. And they say, okay, you take one, you take two, you take three, you take four. And now those four developers just kind of go off to their corners and work on those things by themselves. And then when they come together every day in that daily Scrum meeting, it's a status meeting about this thing that you're working on that the other three developers don't care about, as opposed to, we're all working on one thing, so we're all kind of pigpiling on it, trying to like really tear it apart and drive it to done fast. So if everyone doesn't care, then it's usually because they're not working on the same stuff, which then gets me to this thought of, well, you're not really working as a team. You're just four or five people that sit near each other.
I think that's very common, because if I am working on something with somebody else, I probably need more than their 30-second update anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go talk to them, whether it's on Skype or whether it's in person.
Yeah, well, with Scrum, this comes up when I teach my classes. It's like, so when do I talk to the other developers? It's like, all the time. This meeting is like 15 minutes just to like get focused on making sure that everyone knows what's going on. And then that by no means means that you're not going to talk to them for the rest of the day. You're going to be continually talking. Like, actually, where that continual talking thing really comes in is between people that would be typically considered developers and people that would typically be considered testers. Now, a lot of teams, you'll hear, okay, well, this build's ready. Let's kick it over the wall to QA. Well, then QA goes and finds a bunch of bugs and sends them back to the developers. And it's this sort of tennis match across some imaginary chasm. a lot of times developers and QA testers kind of communicate through Team Foundation Server or Jira, whatever defect management system you want to use. And that really, I think that kind of loses a lot of richness. So if you're communicating with your TFS people, if you're communicating with your testers only through some automated system, well, you're losing out on a lot of stuff. So if you are doing testing together where the developers say, hey, I've got something that's ready to be tested, can you come take a look? Well, that QA person can come bang on it right in front of the developer. Developer maybe can turn around and make the fix if there's a problem right away, so that you're not, so you don't have that super long feedback cycle between dev and test, which, you know, that's sort of getting into some of the DevOps stuff that I've been talking about, is that with DevOps, you're trying to shorten feedback cycles. And one of the feedback cycles is between developers and testers and knowing whether or not the stuff is working.
One of the things I found with the Agile and the Scrum is it can be very useful when you've had a company that's going, let's say, from cowboy coding and they want to do something better. And they're going to transition through Agile, using Agile to being a bit more structured. But I found it to be a terrible impediment when, let's say, I'm working with good developers and I'm working with good QA and everyone's focused and everyone knows what they should be doing. Then I don't need those meetings. And I just kind of, if I need to know something, I'll ask the person who knows and I'll just get on with it. I've found that I don't need the structures if things are going well. It's when things are not going well, I need the structures.
So I'd flip that around a little bit and say, yeah, that sounds exactly right. But part of why you have the structure and that 15-minute meeting per day, I mean, 15 minutes is not a big deal. Part of why you would still want to do that if you have a good team is to detect if things are starting to go off the rails. So to just make sure, you know, for 15 minutes a day, we find out, yes, our plan is still good. But yeah, and that's another thing that's hard with Scrum is when you've got teams that aren't particularly motivated or are not particularly like self-disciplined or however you want to say it, if they're used to being commanded to go do something, then it can be really hard to get that kind of team to start pulling in a self-organizational way.
In your article, the one we're discussing, one of the problems you also see is the idea that we as developers are reporting to the Scrum Master and that the Scrum Master becomes the focus when they shouldn't be.
Yeah. Back to that, you know, everyone goes and works on their own feature. That meeting turns into a status meeting at that point. So the Scrum Master is absolutely, without a doubt, not a project manager. So reporting your status to the Scrum Master is really irrelevant.
But sometimes in companies, the project manager happens to be the Scrum Master too. Is that a bad idea?
Maybe. if that project manager is able to not be a command and control leader, then it's fine. So if they get self-organization and they know how to coach a team to let the team solve their own problems and figure out their route to the ultimate done working software, it's fine. But if that person is just like, you know, project management certified up the wazoo and, you know, did 20 years in the military and like just believes that my way is the right way and that's it, it sometimes can be really hard to have that person coaching that team. Like, actually, I generally will not say that the Scrum Master leads a team. I would say the Scrum Master coaches the team. And it's a subtle difference, but, you know, with a coach, you're trying to help them achieve all that they can possibly achieve and work on their style and work on their impediments and all that kind of stuff. Whereas a leader is a lot more about defining the direction. And it's not always awesome if you've got that kind of leadership style.
But it's to be a little pedantic, sometimes naming and words become important. You give a person partial title of master and they assume a certain amount of control.
Yeah.
you know, it's just one of those things.
I don't have a better name for what Scrum Master should be, but I don't love it.
No, I understand. I mean, I've had another podcast about related topics where companies call developers everything but developers. You know, they're artisans, their guilds, their crafts, their whatever, you know. And then it just becomes, okay, well, why do we need those words? We have other perfectly suitable words. But you know, maybe in this case, we don't have a suitable word.
Yep.
Sorry.
I totally agree with you. And I think it's kind of caused some problems with Scrum in the industry, because that is commonly how people think of it. So if you hear the word master, just like we said, that implies that person is the master of the team. And it's not really what the intention of the word is. It's supposed to be that this person is the master of the Scrum process, the keeper of the Scrum process, and they understand how to coach that process into the team. I don't know. This is the difference between theory and reality. Like, you can read the Scrum Guide, which is, you know, free download from scrum.org. And it's a fairly short read. Like, it's just the rules of Scrum. But when you get out into the real world, then you start dealing with humans, and that's where it starts to get really kind of complicated.
It does miss that. One final thing on your from your article, you're not a fan of the three questions, what did you do yesterday, what are you doing today, and any blockers.
It goes into that status report thing. So the three questions format really gets people into that, I'm reporting my status to the Scrum Master mode, or when really you're trying to get to how are we moving towards delivering done working software. And one of the things I don't particularly like about three questions is that it's kind of accusatory. It's like, all right, what did you do yesterday? Because or just lie to me. I know that you didn't do anything. I know you surfed Facebook and ESPN all day yesterday. So go ahead, lie to me. What'd you do yesterday? All right. What do you say you're going to do today? Because I want to have a good laugh when we get to tomorrow's meeting. And then any impediments? No. What a surprise. Next. Like that attitude is not very healthy. And that's how it is on a lot of teams. And, you know, I worked on this team for the government a bunch of years ago. And like, when I think about it, everything that everyone said every day was garbage. Like, everyone thought they were going to do X, Y, and Z. And then the next day you'd find out they did none of that. And part of it was because the project was so chaotic. And then everyone had their own thing that they were working on. So it was, we really didn't make the kind of progress that we should have been doing. And also, it was kind of funny, is we'd spend all this effort creating a plan for the sprint, like tasking out all the PBIs and all that. And then as soon as we'd start the sprint, we'd never look at that stuff again. So it was like, well, what the hell are we doing?
I remember, I was just looking for a name and I can't remember which one, but I'm pretty sure one of the signers or the authors of the Agile Manifesto has in the last few years come out and said, it's just not working. People are not doing it. You can't do it. And he's come up with a new manifesto. I don't want to say which name I think it is in case I'm wrong, but I know it's one of those. And it just feels very strange to me that the complaint from him wasn't that it doesn't work. It's that no one's doing it right. And it kind of reminds me of times I've met certain people who would be proponents of an old economic manifesto, and they would say, well, it didn't work in that country because no one did it right, or they didn't do it right, but it does work. And sort of, it hasn't worked anywhere, and you can guess what I'm talking about.
It's kind of, it's an abstraction. Like, in the abstract, it's like, yeah, that sounds perfect, but when it actually hits human beings, then it's kind of hard to do. What I'm kind of thinking about is, like, if you've got an organization that can do Scrum and can embrace that sort of agile mindset and the self-organization over command and control, then it's going to go great. But not everyone's wired that way. So thinking about how I consult with companies, like a lot of my peers in the Scrum.org trainer community, like I think that we sort of go into different buckets. Like some people want full precision, like you have to do Scrum all the way through or you guys are awful. And the way that I tend to think of it is I actually kind of like working with teams that are just getting going or organizations that are just getting going, because you can have such an improvement on their lives, even if they pick up 20% of what's in Scrum or 20% of what's in the Agile Manifesto, you know, because they're kind of like passed out on the ground, like with their shoelaces tied together, trying to get software delivered. And like, if you just pick up a handful of things, like definition of done and focusing on really getting your work all the way to full completion. And what does that mean? Like that, when I talk about that in my classes or in my talks, you can see the lights going on in people's heads. Like, oh yeah, we don't focus on getting one thing done before we move on to the next thing. We do 20 things simultaneously and it's hard. So like, I don't even know if that necessarily is Scrum. That's just like, here, like think about how you work and don't multitask. Like multitasking is death for productivity.
Yeah. I'm just reading Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And multitasking, he says, is an incredible draw on your resources. It's incredibly hard to context switch. It breaks your concentration. It uses up your energy. And yet, in a realistic business environment, we as developers are expected to have, you know, a end of the sprint in focus. There's going to be a release. There's money tied to it. But guess what? Production is down. Oh, I need to fix this bug. And guess what?
Yeah.
You know, there's a junior developer who's doing something badly and I need to fix that too. We can't expect to live in isolation from the money, and the money is what drives us in a sense.
So the big problem that I see in software development is that I don't know, were you a nerd growing up?
Somewhat, yeah, but okay. not I used to do sports too. I used to like the outdoors.
Okay. You're one of those people. You know, as a kid, I was nerdy and I was picked on, and a lot of other people were picked on in software development. And one of the things that I think that we learned, you know, really early back in elementary school on the playground, it was like reading what this person who is picking on us wants and giving it to them as fast as possible so they don't steal our lunch or hang us up on the lockers or whatever. And the problem is that kind of got welded in, like that's in the firmware now. So when, you know, we bring it forward into our professional career, we've got people that come in and yell at us saying, I got to have this, blah, 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 scream, scream, scream. And it's that habit is still in there. And one of the things that Scrum is trying to do is to provide a framework for saying, no, this is not realistic. Like, we wanted to do X, Y, and Z, but that's just proving empirically to be false. We cannot deliver at that rate. Here's what we actually can do. Here's the data to back it up. And now when we talk to the business people, we can say, well, here's why we have estimates the way they are. These estimates are merely estimates. It's a forecast of what we can do. And we expect them to work with us and collaborate with us and vice versa to deliver something reasonable. Like having, just because someone wants it, because the VP of operations is screaming the loudest, doesn't necessarily mean we're going to get 8 weeks worth of work in 2 weeks worth of time. And no amount of screaming is going to make that true. So what software developers tend to do is we tend to say, yeah, okay, we'll make it happen. And it's a lie. It's a total lie.
Or like, it may work. Maybe 8 weeks into two doesn't, but 6 weeks into four. But then you've got a lot of exhausted, pissed off developers with bad code. But you've set the expectation that it can be done. And then next time, I remember having a CTO going, I could do this in an hour, something that would, you know, take a week. And I was tempted to embarrass him in front of everyone and go, all right, I'm going to give $1,000 to any charity of your choice if you sit down with me for an hour and do it.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, you know, it would have probably been the point.
I think that you probably would have gotten fired it would have made for a really good podcast, and I would laugh. But yeah, well, that's, you know, that's part of it. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into getting this software out the door. Like, I've been saying this a lot in conference talks. One of the big things that's wrong with our industry is the name, the software development industry. When you think of software development industry, you think of software developers. And, well, software is not the same now as it was in the 70s or 80s or even the 90s. It takes teams of people of various skills and various talents to get this stuff out the door. Now, if you start thinking about it as software delivery industry, then that really changes your focus to, okay, well, it's not just about the coding part. It's about the testing and the ops and the database stuff and the backup plans and the yada, yada, yada. And that's what that CTO who's saying, I could do this in an hour. That's what's going on. They're thinking about, yeah, okay, that's a 2-second code fix. But in reality, there's a lot more around it. And if you ship something that is hot steaming pile of garbage, well, that's going to catch up with you. Maybe it works right this second, but maintenance wise, you're going to come back and you're going to, like, if you manage to get 8 weeks worth of work done in 2 weeks, you're going to have to come back and do 6 weeks worth of maintenance in short order.
I remember as well, I'll come to what you said at a presentation I saw you giving, but your point that it's all about people as well, and that's missed in these manifestos, and it's missed maybe in the daily stand-ups and the scrums. And it takes into account the software delivery, the dates, the time, the cost, but it doesn't take into account the personalities or the arguments or the clashes. Yeah. And I remember you I think maybe in CodeCamp again, you were saying how life for you improved personally, but also your ability to deal with people when you started seeing a therapist.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't gone for a while, but man, did that really help. Like, I think the story that I told was that I went for some stuff that was going on with my family, and we kind of cleared that out, in like a handful of visits. And the therapist was like, well, anything you want to talk about with work? And I'm like, nope, everything's perfect at work. And then she's like, well, let's just dig into this anyway. And as we dig in, we realize that it's like, oh, I'm kind of a jerk sometimes. And I melt down in certain ways. And it was really powerful stuff. Like, I'm not going to say that I'm necessarily the most charming person all the time. Like, I can be a difficult guy. But it really helped to get going on that. And once I saw that, I'm like, oh, this stuff is magic. So the way that I think of myself in my career is that I've turned into a therapist for teams. So I have taken I don't
be a very good title, Ben Day, yeah. Therapist for teams.
Yeah, you should put that on the podcast episode.
Well, I think that'll be the title.
I started taking some coaching classes, like how do you become a life coach, and not necessarily because I want to be a life coach, but because that stuff is so helpful in leading self-organized teams, like just ways of how you would ask questions in an open-ended manner, and how do you coach people through difficult conversations. Actually, that's a great book, Difficult Conversations by, I think her name is Sheila Heen. Just such an awesome book to read. But it's like so much of the stuff that we do in software has practically nothing to do with tools or coding or whatever. It's all about that, you know, people don't want to play well together.
No, I completely agree. I remember I've been in scenarios where, I work with someone who was very competent. I felt I was competent, and it felt like we were disagreeing. We weren't being in any way belligerent towards each other or rude, but then we realized that we were actually agreeing and saying the same thing. But we got to that without being antagonizing. And then from then on, it was sort of, we would often end up with disagreements. And then we go, hang on. Maybe we agree, we're just not saying it correctly. Yeah. And that was generally the case. And then another scenario I recall, a colleague of mine made, I made a recommendation, and my colleague said, no, I don't think that, no, that wouldn't be right. I go, okay, that's fine. You know, I knew I was right. I was positive, but I wasn't going to force it. I go out for lunch. I come back. And my colleague first thing says to me, I was thinking about that, and I think you're right. And, you know, in a different company or with a different, two different opposing people, that could have turned into an argument and people digging their heels in. And it wouldn't matter who's right. You just wouldn't let the other person win.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that sort of sounds like you're, like, it sounds like what you did is exactly perfect. Like, let's just back up. We don't have to resolve this right this second. We'll come back and reapproach later on. But if you'd done the opposite thing and actually like pushed into it, like then there's a lot more on the line. There's like your identity as a developer and your identity as an expert. And like that is met on the other side with that person's identity as an expert and as a developer or whatever. And like people just, yeah, you're right. They just dig in on that stuff. So recognizing that that was what was happening, having that awareness of what's happening on the meta level of that conversation is tremendously important. I was like, that's super wise of you to just step back and give it a breath.
Yeah, it feels like the sort of the difference between in the bad scenario, one person winning and one person losing. Whereas in this scenario, you're just stating an opinion, you think you're right, and you're hoping the other person will come around to it too. And then you both win, and there's no conflict.
Yeah.
And most of the time, conflict is what causes the problems because that becomes ingrained. And then you don't want to deal with that person. You think they're an a-hole. And you know, and I've worked with colleagues like that where incredible belligerence grew and grew to the point of they would dismiss every idea of yours. It wouldn't matter what it was.
Yeah. At that point, the relationship is pretty poisonous and you kind of have to work on that.
Some people don't want to work on relationships.
Well, because one of the things that I love about being on stage and saying, hey, I think everyone should go see a therapist is just like you can hear 300 butt cheeks clench up at once. Like it's just everyone's just like that's oogie feelings.
And the 10% who don't want to raise their hands and say they're already going, or 20% or whatever it is.
There's no way. Like, yeah, when you ask, like, how many of you see a therapist, you get two people. And, like, there is no way that it's only two people in a room of 300 or whatever. But it's, like, people, I don't know, we're in a male-dominated industry. Dudes are not famous for being in touch with their feelings. And it's really important to get going on that. And, you know, as I've crossed the transition into 40, I think that I just don't need to be right as much anymore. Like, I realize that I'm right pretty often, but I don't need credit for stuff. I don't necessarily have to, I don't want to be the person that has all the answers anymore. And it's more fun to work with people as a team now, to as a team come together and as a team be right. It just, I don't know, like, I don't, that might be therapy, it might not.
To kind of wrap up our agile discussion, you have a few courses on Pluralsight on this?
I've got the two classes that pop into my head right now. I've got a Scrum Master Skills class, which is, you know, 4 or 5 hours worth of how do you really get good at Scrum? How do you improve your Scrum practice at your company? How do you get good as a Scrum Master? What are the dysfunctions? All that kind of stuff. I also have this is going to be hard to say, Real World Scrum with TFS 2013 class. So how do you do Scrum with TFS? And then the new class is going to be DevOps with TFS 2015 and Visual Studio 2015. Which the DevOps class doesn't do as much with Agile and Scrum, but it at least talks about it a little bit.
Before we started this podcast, I had the intention of talking about half of it on Agile and then half of it on DevOps in the Microsoft world. But we've already hit about 40 minutes. So what I'm going to do is we're going to cut the podcast here.
Okay.
I'm going to release this one as Ben Day Team Therapist or something of that nature. And I'm going to make a second podcast of the DevOps one. So
okay.
I'll be releasing the Binday on Team Therapy, and then some weeks later I'll release the other one.
Okay.
So I'm going to wrap this one, and thank you very much for this one, Ben. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was When by Steven Seibert from the album Personal Soundwaves.